Australia, Wanju. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Curb. I'm Andrew F. Pierce, and this is the podcast where I bring you in-depth interviews with filmmakers, creatives, and creators of culture. This podcast is recorded in Boorloo, Western Australia, sovereignty never ceded. After having its world premiere at the Adelaide Film Festival in 2024 and screening at South by Southwest and Sydney Film Festival, Kate Blackmore's essential documentary, Make It Look Real, is now available to view on Netflix. I followed the journey of this documentary with keen interest, having discussed the film at length in conversation with Kate and the co-star Albert Mwangi, and now I bring you the conversation full circle with producer Bethany Bruce. In this deep conversation, Bethany talks about her journey into the arts, what her interest in producing has been, how her work with Staple Fiction is changing storytelling on Australian screens, and what it was like to work with Kate on this powerful documentary. If this is the first time that you're hearing of Make It Look Real, then welcome. This is a documentary that lifts the veil on intimacy coordinators, following their journey in film from the initial phases to the day of the shoot. In between scenes of working through the intimacy coordinator process, the film also explores how films like Last Tango in Paris could have benefited from having an intimacy coordinator on set. Additionally, while this film is about film and TV production, it does open up discussions for others about consent when it comes to personal relationships. Check out Make It Look Real on Netflix right now, and to find out more about Bethany's work, visit staplefiction.com.au. I'll stick a link in the show notes. If you want to find out more about the work that we do on The Curb, then head over to thecurb.com.au or follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Blue Sky at thecurb.au. We're a completely independent and ad-free website that lives on support of listeners and readers just like yourself. So if you want to provide us with a little bit of support, anything from as little as $1 a month, then visit patreon.com/thecurb.au. And if you're unable to financially support us, then please consider sharing this interview with your film-loving friends. We'd also love it if you could rate and review us on the podcast player of your choice. Every review helps amplify the interviews and stories from filmmakers to a wider audience. New interviews get published on a Thursday, with bonus episodes just like this one getting published on Tuesdays. Keep an eye out as well. We've got a bunch of MIF conversations on the horizon. Thecurb.com.au is where you're going to find all of that. Right, here's the trailer for Make It Look Real, followed by my interview with producer Bethany Bruce.
Legs here, like, to be a little lower.
Undulations from the stomach, and then maybe on beat three, it can come up into the shoulders.
So that you're getting maximum impact.
Cheekbone here, the anchors to inner thigh, and it is close and it is vulnerable.
I'm going to be working on a new film.
There's a kind of anticipation, knowing that anything can happen. Every actor I work with has some kind of story, from uncomfortable to downright assault. Actors are trained to say yes to anything.
She seems to be a little overwhelmed with the idea of a threesome.
Cut there. Thank you.
Got it.
Very nice.
If we don't set up a structure, then we're setting our actors up for permanent damage.
Settling in, everybody, nice and quiet.
This idea that it has to be real, otherwise it won't look real. That's just not true.
Does that feel comfortable? Give that a good rub.
Your interest in storytelling on film and TV, where did that come from? Where did your interest in becoming a storyteller this way kick off?
I loved stories and had just a real curiosity in people from a young age. Growing up, my parents had a really diverse, friendship group. I had a massive family. And a big family in terms of, like, my grandmother was one of 13 and, you know, my great-grandmother's still alive. She's 103. My great-grandmother. So in my family, stories were always being told. Like, you know, you would have lunch and it'd be like, oh, did you hear about this thing? And, oh, this funny person did this, or, you know, and there'd always be that little three-act structure and a payoff, you know. And it was just really interested me, and, you know, the unusual ways that people do things, or I'm really interested in the choices people make and why. And I think there's definitely that anthropological, you know, part of my work where it is just about like curiosity and observation, which is why when I started making documentaries, I was like, wow, I love this. Like, this form is just incredible. And yeah, I'm very passionate about how we see ourselves and what it can show us and sort of, yeah. And then layered on top of that, when I was growing up, I did classical piano. So I did that from about 8 years old, which was a bit of an unusual choice. My parents, not my dad, like shaped surfboards, and they weren't, you know, really into like classical music or anything. But that was, I guess, my sort of first formal introduction to art as a form, and in terms of like how hard you have to work something. You know, it would take me a year to learn a piece, just one piece, and I guess then that gave me this sort of layer of like rigor, which I think you've got to have that interest in story, but then there's that kind of rigor of understanding the form and then how it, you know, how you can get it to an audience, or what does this all mean? And so those two things were like, oh, I thought maybe I want to go and study music, but then I actually was like, I'm going to study film. So I enrolled into UTS straight out of high school into the media arts production program, which was incredible for me at that time. Like, coming, I lived about an hour and a half out of the city, you know, getting the train in, shooting on film, you know, so I started literally shooting on 16 mil film in that first year and just making films. And that was the video hire center right where we studied at the Bond Marsh building, just getting cameras and making works with my friends, my colleagues, and just went from there and sort of just have stayed in it by hook or by crook.
Yeah, well, it's good.
Without any sort of formal journey, it's just being me going, oh, I just love this. And not necessarily Hollywood, like, you know, looking back, I would love to maybe go to LA and try the assistant path. And I had a really close friend of mine who's done that and who's actually very successful at that now. But I was much more of like a rogue, you know, I was like, oh, I just want to kind of make stuff. And, you know, I don't know. Yeah, I didn't really have any sort of formal approach to the industry. It was just, I did my study. I was lucky to get in that course because it was really competitive at the time. And, you know, Commonwealth supported places, which they don't really have now, like, it's very expensive to study. And yeah, I just have stuck with it, and I absolutely love it. It is my life. I don't have kids, so like, you know, my films are my babies. But yeah, I could not see myself doing anything else. So, it's just got me hooked. I'm just always interested in, and it's stories, and then on top of that, it's the people I work with and the projects. It's sort of like that makes it enjoyable, and being able to have collaborators who are just so smart and exciting to work with and offering up interesting things that keeps me curious. And then that's how I approach it, even from, I guess, a financing perspective. I feel, you know, I'm very director focused, so I'm not a sort of slate or focused on the sort of like looking at it from that kind of building up the slate, or let's build a big company and have lots of things on there. And, you know, I'd like to get to that stage eventually, but still for now I'm very much focused on like the director. I'm drawn to the directors, and that's a big part of my strategy, if you would call it, like the producer-director relationship. And if the direct, because I work mostly with like auteurs, although I've just started doing a few projects where I'm just working with writers on IP that we're adapting, existing IP. But everyone has to want it is really what I feel with like getting a project up. You know, if the director and the particular director really wants it, whether you've attached them or they've come to you with a project and you want it and you're kind of moving together energetically in the independent world, I think that's what makes a project happen. Because you can kind of, you know, you can find money if you really want it. If you both really want it and you're going to like, you know, go for it, you'll make it happen. But you've got to have that perfect balance of pushing it at the same time, you know. So anyway, yeah, so that's been kind of my journey.
I ask people it quite a bit, and it's interesting the level of kind of, you just take it for granted that when you step into filmmaking and it's like, well, I always wanted to be a filmmaker. But sometimes that journey, like you were saying, the impact of stories, right? And it being passed along generations from grandparents to parents to you and now to an audience, like that's quite a it's something that I don't think that we give enough attention or affection to as well, because it's a gift to be able to do that. Which brings me to like a collaborative work. Like you've worked alongside Kate for almost 10 years now, I think. Yeah.
10 years. Yeah.
So
yeah.
When you find somebody who's in synergy with you as a storyteller, what's that like?
Yeah, it's really incredible. And like Kate and I started off, we were introduced by Bridget Eichen, who's a mentor of mine, and I did a Screenstray producer attachment with them in from 2014 to 2016. And I worked on a bunch of their slate, and then Bridget introduced me to Kate, and I'd looked at her work. She'd done this great piece, Girls, and there was just something in it that I looked at that had reminded me of, you know, what early work that I'd made, or just her gaze, or the way that she saw these young girls who were from like Ingleburn in Western Sydney, or they were just these girls, and you know, they wanted to be something, and their lives meant so much, and yet their surroundings were, you know, you would look at it and you're like, oh, she's just in a gum tree, and look at that, you know, where she is. Or and I just saw something immediately in Kate's work that was similar to mine. Even at uni, all my shorts were about women. I made a little short called Gonna Do Bakery, and it was about these two girls trying to get out of the bakery to go to the city. And like, yeah, we just met, and we both had this interest in women's stories, but just seeing artists, so women who were trying to do something or make something almost out of nothing, whether that was art or in their own lives, or we were very, you know, you were just interested in those smaller things at the time. And Kate was from an arts background, so she hadn't really made films before, which I kind of loved, because, you know, even though I'd had formal training, it wasn't like fully formal, you know, it was like grabbing a camera and just, you know, getting into it. And so we started with The Glass Bedroom, which was about Instagram artists and, you know, the power of social media. You know, 10 years ago, that was still quite new, these artists using Instagram as their own gallery or their own platform, and taking a bit of that sort of power back. And we got that finance with was like a Screen Australia Art Bites commission. So it was a commission project. So we were able to, you know, pay everyone and finance our first project with Felix Media, where I worked at the time. And that did well for us with the ABC at that time. And so we had three subsequent commissions of series, online doc series on iView. And that was just a great start. You know, we were able to kind of pay ourselves and be making films as sort of working filmmakers together. And we did Video Becomes Us, which was about video artists, once again about, you know, very political in terms of, you know, these sort of artists in very niche ways making bigger statements and, you know, looking at that. And then we did the Art of Collecting, which was about artists' collections. So they're, you know, all their little objects they collect and the stories they tell. So it interests me because they're like these very small worlds and stories, but then when we'd piece them together on screen, they were very powerful, and, you know, anyone could watch them on an eye view and understand something about the art world or making art, but also feel empowered how accessible it can be in their own lives. There's art and there's beauty in all of our lives. And that was something that I really liked about working for Kate, with Kate, just the way that she saw things. And, you know, we're collaborators, and as well, for me, my sort of role as a producer is I really see myself in service to the director's vision. So I work like that, like with Kate and, you know, on the shorts and obviously on the feature. But then with other directors I've worked with, it's just very much about I love what they're doing so much. Like there's something there and I just want to like make it happen. And really, I'm more curious often in these more like auteur collaborations in what they're doing and what they see than what even I think might, you know, be a more interesting choice. Like I'm always more interested in their choices and what they're doing. And that's, I guess, I think that's the sort of pretty classic for, you know, a producer working with auteurs. You've got to just, yeah, love what the directors are offering up. And you know, some producers I've worked with, they might think, oh, my idea would be better, you know, but I don't feel that. I'm always more curious. And artists too, I often find they're way ahead of the zeitgeist. So I see things like, you know, even down to the detail of like a color grade choice they'll choose or the way they'll open a scene, you know, 5 years later, or you see it in the films in like Cannes and other, you know, directors Fortnite. And then 5 years later, you see it in all like the blockbuster films and you're like, you know, and that's what I love. And I've seen it in my work. You know, I see a director trying to do something and then, they're like 2-3 years ahead of zeitgeist. And I feel very much about that with Kate. And I think that's because she was from the art world, performance art, and her work with Barbara Cleveland, her collective, is pretty incredible too. And there's just something that interests me about that. And I love directors that actually sometimes come from not the film world specifically. Like I think that's, you know, I worked with a director who's an architect and that was really interesting. So, yeah, it's been a very incredible bond and we've made our career together and we're also very close friends. So that's lovely too, you know. It's very lucky to have those bonds because it's quite intensive working, you know, you're in touch all the time and making decisions, thousands of decisions over time together, you know, and supporting each other. So yeah, I feel very lucky for that introduction from Bridget and to have sustained and maintained that relationship feels pretty special.
Well, I mean, as you're saying, like a lot of the role of a producer is facilitating the vision of a director and getting that on screen. But a lot of the work that you've done with Kate is about what we see on screen and the impact of it as well. Like you're talking about going back to stories about Instagram and how people relate and interact with that platform. And then, of course, you know, there's the butter scene as well, which is literally about watching and impacting the impact of a particular scene in a major film. And then going to Make It Look Real, which is about the engagement of what we're seeing. Is it consensual? And so all of this kind of relationships of our relationship as an audience member, seeing what we're seeing on screen, but then the actors or the subject's story, how they're interacting with it. And so it feels like a conscious thing, but I know sometimes these things happen by, you know, accident in a way. Has it been a conscious choice to present what we see on screen and interrogate that in a creative way?
I do feel that it is a part of the work. It when we sort of started making work, I think looking back now, I don't know that it would have been intentional, but it was always it was always what we would talk about, you know, all the time. So when we're making the glass bedroom, I loved one of the participants, Amy. And I remember when we went out to her house and she's just this incredibly beautiful, you know, she looks like a high fashion model that could belong in the pages of Vogue. And, you know, when we went to her place, you know, there was elements of, you know, modesty and just this, like, in terms of, you know, how even how she was living and how she'd set up her photo shoots, which looked so, you know, high gloss. And she was just making something really out of nothing. And then when we were looking at the image, we just so much came out of us, like her beauty, but she's so smart, how she was, you know, there were these like breast sculptures and she'd have them. And, you know, it was like, you know, she was playing into the kind of, you know, male gaze in a way. And she was, had followers from all different fan bases. And we're just like, it's just so smart how, you know, what she's doing. Does she even know what she's doing? And that interested us. And I think we'd always then look at the way women were kind of presenting themselves on screen, you know, whether it's social media or like Kim Kardashian, which we'll talk about, you know, like how women hold audience and how they see themselves and present themselves and, you know, make a living and, you know, that really around all of it, it looks like it's a lot, but then when you sort of peel back the layers, there's a simplicity to the creation of imagery. And so the glass bedroom, I think for me, was the real seeds of that. And then I liked Video Becomes Us as well, because these women were also video artists, which is a bit more niche, right? But also really radical and kind of similar to social media, but more sort of niche and in the art world, but kind of doing the same thing. And then with the seeds of Make It Look Real really came from, and at Kate and I, and we'd have these chats just about how powerful women were. Like, you look at Marilyn Monroe, she built a studio. Like, she literally, like, the value, dollar value of her to that studio is, you know, it'd be billions. Like, and these gorgeous women, you know, the Wizard of Oz in The Art of Collecting, David's episode, which I love, is about, but Judy Garland, we'd always talk about Judy Garland and, you know, just how she built, she was Wizard of Oz. I mean, you look at the IP of Wizard of Oz, billions and billions, we'd even get to the trillions, like, seriously, in terms of the amount of returns that had happened. Just the value of that IP, it is the studio, right? Wizard of Oz is, you know, and how these women sort of remain, really, they do. I mean, they're in the popular consciousness. Or for me in the 90s, you know, it was Princess Di. So Kate and I both just had this real interest in like women, but powerful women that are, I guess, behind the camera or their image is really proliferated. And what that means and how actually, if you look back, you know, it's being controlled by men predominantly. They didn't really control their image and they didn't really benefit or make money of it. Or, you know, they became addicts maybe from the stress or, you know, Judy Garland had quite a sad end to her life, you know, as did Marilyn. Or you can look at any other women that have kind of been proliferated in the media. These are the things that really interested me about Kate's work specifically, like more personally, I guess, talking about the proliferation of women's imagery is that Kate was interested in that too, though coming at it, I guess, from a more specific way, like very specific her work is. And so whilst there's that bigger idea, the specific idea was, well, you know, she read about Maria's experience on the on Last Tango in Paris and how to complete that, you know, the abuse happened on set, yet the film was a big success. It wasn't well accepted at the time, but it still, you know, was a sort of studio film and it's held up over time. And Marlon was a huge actor. It was a big opportunity for her and the film sort of became bigger than her, but her whole life was interrupted in a way. I mean, she never really recovered from that experience. It tainted her whole life in a way and that she couldn't get away from. And if you read about her, it was a sad life that she'd had, and, you know, then dying later of cancer, you know, serious illness. And it you read about it and it just feels like there's this deep, great sadness, even though really, even as a woman and as an artist, she still really stays alive, and she's still talked about, and her coming out about the abuse on that set had a ripple effect. You know, it was only a couple of years prior to Me Too. It was really one of the first seeds of that movement. Journalists picked up on the article, and that ripple effect kind of continued on. And for me, that's also what I take out of the Me Too movement, you know, beyond those stories of abuse and those survivors. I deeply appreciate what they did, and I feel deeply for them at the same time. Though looking at it from another layer, I just feel it was like 100 years of Hollywood history where women built the studios, their blood, their sweat, their tears, you know, and they were on the can, you know, they were what sold the films. And from Marilyn to Judy, and you know, there's so many other incredible, you know, actresses. Yeah, there's abuse, you know, they weren't paid well, they were mistreated, like, you know, Alfred Hitchcock's films as well, you know, The Birds with Tippi, and yeah, it goes on. And and I just felt there was never really that reckoning for Me Too. It was just about like fairness and equity in the workplace and just treating women right. And, you know, if these big, beautiful, powerful actresses couldn't even in Hollywood today, they don't feel safe. You know, how does a woman feel on the office floor, you know, starting out in her career, or, you know, sort of, yeah, I don't know. It's so that Kate's lens is very specific, and that's what I was really interested in. But for me as a producer, I'm always looking at like the bigger, you know, the kind of what's the bigger story, or like what is the juice of this, and how does it kind of lead to other kind of conversations. And so then that for me really drew me to Kate's work, because I find that, you know, the best directors, or certainly that I've worked with, and they have this very specific, almost very narrow lens and very specific focus. And you want them really to be really focused in their world too as a producer. You know, you never really want to pull them out of that. But then later on when the work is made, you know, there's all these, like I was talking about Pardon Note, like there's so many layers to that film. There's all different layers than a viewer could extract, you know, bringing their worldview or perspective. But there is power in that sort of, in the specific, that then leads to these bigger conversations. And I think as an artist as well, that's what really draws me to working with Kate. That's the lens that she brings on things that I think matter to a lot of people, you know, how image is controlled, and you know, how women didn't really have much of a say in how they controlled their image, and now they do. And I feel like that's sort of at the heart of a lot of our work.
But there's also the power of cinema so good in being able to instigate change. And that, I think, is what sits at the core of Make It Look Real, sure. too. Yeah. It's this notion of being able to influence or change an industry and to highlight something that is currently underway. Like the use of intimacy coordinators is increased, which is really great to see. Yeah. Can you talk about the role of Make It Look Real in the power of change and the strength of change that it might have? And I don't know if you want to bring up any kind of anecdotes that you might have had from your trip to South by Southwest as well, if people have seen the impact of change with it.
Yes. So with Make It Look Real, what I think the sort of power of it is to actually show what the intimacy coordinator does. So it's, you know, it's observational, and the scenario that's set up with Tightrope and with Kieran Darcy-Smith, the director. And I think that an audience is just able to see the level of care that the intimacy coordinator brings, and all of those many, many minor decisions that are made by us as individuals when we're asserting our boundaries, and when we're in a relationship trying to kind of like work out consent, or yes, I'm comfortable with this, or yes, you can touch me there. And those are the things, I guess, on a very essential level that I think any audience could come to the film and watch it. And for me, even myself, I learned so much about it, how you could have a conversation around, you know, your consent levels in a really like you know, casual and accessible way. So yeah, the heart of the film is a sort of exploration through Claire's role on consent and consent conversations, and how easy and fun and funny it can be and awkward it can be. But it can just make, it could make relationships and our own sexuality just actually a lot more seamless and freeing, you know, to be able to just have these conversations. And for me, that's what I love so much about this film, because, you know, Claire would be like, you know, okay, cheek here to inner thigh. And like, it was so like instructive to the actors around what, you know, what they were going to do in the scene. So they felt totally comfortable. And even the way, like the language Claire would use, I'd be like, you know, sometimes be upset having a little giggle or something, hearing it in my, hearing it in my ear. And I'm just like, wow, like the fact that, and that's her business, is talking about, you know, our bodies and what feels comfortable and, you know, how we're going to do this. And it's super accessible for an audience. So, you know, for example, any intimacy coordinator haters or people that don't quite understand the role, from even actors themselves to just any other punter who would be like, oh, this is more woke culture, you know, what even is this? The actors can't even just perform sex now without this monitor. It's not about that at all. It's just about comfortability and taking out some of that sting or awkwardness of like sex itself and intimacy, even in our day-to-day lives, but then on set, in front of cameras, in front of a whole crew, filmed on something that's going to maybe live forever for the actor and be around, that they may change their mind about at any time. Do you know what I mean? So they might feel comfortable in the moment, oh, just going for it, and maybe they've had some whiskey, or they've, you know, they're sort of attracted to their co-star a bit, so they're like, oh yeah. And then like 10 years later, they're like, oh no, I didn't feel comfortable at all, and I really wish I hadn't have done that, or I had a modesty garment here or there. Because film has such a long life, it is not in the moment like our own sex lives, you know. I think for me, that's what I hope audiences take away, you know, not this big sort of political message, because Claire's role is inherently political, right? You know, and that's what drew Claire, Kate and I to it. Like I said earlier about our work, it's those small, those like almost kind of hidden figures, but literally like hidden figures, like in the industry or in our day to day, that are like doing actually incredible work or political work or making ripple effects of change just by kind of doing their job, which is, yeah, I that's what I do love about the role of intimacy coordinator, because it, for many actresses, and I think younger actors and actresses that don't have access to power, say like a Gwyneth Paltrow, huge power, that might not be able to speak up for themselves, and they have someone like Claire, who's the most honest, the most caring, beautiful person, like just there for them, going like, okay, he's going to be down here, are you cool with that? Do you want an extra padding, or, you know, do you want some mint spray? Like, or, and they're like, actually, I don't really want him down there. Just, you know, I don't know why. And she's like, no worries, we'll just change the blocking, or the camera will be here, or, you know. And it's just that very practical person in all our lives, where you just like, you know, you go or you meet them or some service or facility or something you need to do, and they're there, and they're just there for you, and that, you know, making you feel comfortable and human and, you know, looked after. And so I hope that's what people take away, you know, obviously beyond all of the other sort of very heated discussion around it, and the fact that, you know, in America at this time, it's that sort of far right kind of very political kind of, you know, oh, anti-woke culture. Obviously it's, you know, I'm sure there would be some discussions around that, but yeah, at its essence, it's just about care. And that's really was my takeaway from working on it as well.
But it's also a lot about advocacy as well. And that's, it's what we're talking about in the role of being a producer. And I'm curious then, having made the film, what will you change as your work as a producer, having learned from Claire, from working with Kate, from working with the actors on Make It Look Real?
That's such a great question. I definitely really scrutinize my process through making this film. It was quite interesting because I really, even the atmosphere of our set with Claire, Claire was an advocate, you know, for herself and for others and for the actors. And as a producer, that kind of, you know, level of care and advocacy for me has always really been quite central to my work. Like, I have been always very much people over project, or certainly people over profits, but, you know, speak now, maybe one day. I've always brought that, and I've had that sort of feedback from people about, you know, the atmosphere on the set always feels pretty safe and good. But I would definitely, for me, it arose broader questions around like psychosocial safety on a set. Like, mental health is such a huge thing in our industry in terms of like our crew, making sure, you know, as a producer, that you've got all those elements in place, and that, you know, everybody's feeling comfortable on your set, and that you're really upfront about what the type of work is going to be, and, you know, really what is required. Because for independent films, it's, you know, it is often long hours, or it's minimum, you know, MEW minimums. And I feel that there's also that element of, you know, sort of clarity that a producer can kind of bring, so everyone knows what it is, you know, they're getting into. And I think sort of just treatment and equity on set is really important as well. So respecting, say, like a role like Claire, it's interesting because it might take, you know, a bit longer sometimes to kind of, I don't know, you might need to build in a little bit of more rehearsal time or something like that as a producer, but it is just so worthwhile to do that. And I think producers are also about risk mitigation, right? It's a huge part of producing is you just take on huge risk, honestly. And actually, when I got into it, I didn't really realize what I was doing. After the first feature, I do realize now, huge financial risk. But not just that, you've got all these people who are really in your care. So really just making sure that, you know, you're mitigating risk of harm for any of them, wellness, whether that's wellness, long hours, rest, making sure that, you know, there's clear communication. And a role like Claire, some producers might be, particularly indie producers, might be like, oh, I can't afford intimacy coordinator. Like, you know, it's, I just, you know, but I would encourage them to just think about, you know, that long tail your film has as well, but both for the actors that are in it and the sort of the marketing distribution and how you feel about it now, which is sort of what I was saying a bit about the actors themselves, will change over time. Like, you know, you might, and also could lead to other issues for you, you know, whether they be like legal or financial, if you just don't do it properly at the time, which is so hard for producers because you've got so much going on and so many competing priorities. But, you know, really, it is about care. I mean, that's for me really what I learned, just as much care as you can put into something. It's a people business, it's a human business. So,
well, it's also, and I mean that again, it underpins what a storytelling role of storytelling is. It's about building empathy, and if you don't have a foundation of that, of care and empathy and support for the people who you're helping make the story with, then that translates to what we see on screen.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. I feel that. And energetically, I feel it too. When you're on set and things are working, it's like what I was saying earlier about the producer and director being like committed to making the project, and it's the same level of like energy on the set. You can really notice it when everybody really wants to be there, like, and is in the right frame of mind to be there and knows what it is they're getting into, and they've been properly briefed, and they're really there to kind of make this sort of art together, and uncertain of how it's going to turn out. Most people, even on sets, you know, have always like, oh, what, you know, are we doing the right thing, you know? So yeah.
Look, it's been really good to be able to talk it through with you, especially like, because I've talked about the film with Albert. I talked about it with Kate. Yeah.
I loved Albert. That was so good. Thank you for that. Yeah. I just loved working with Albert. I think it's something really special there, and he is such a great person and a really passionate creative too. And he's also got a lot of, you know, even what he's bringing, his other interests in terms of, you know, making a career for himself. And
he's going to be huge. I'm looking forward to seeing where his career goes.
I must say, he really, that's a feedback we had out of Austin. We had a lot of actors actually saying how much they love the film, and they felt they were like, oh, I wish everyone, you know, producers and things could see this. And a lot of like Gen Z younger women as well, which was surprised about, who were maybe just sort of interested in maybe the arts more broadly. But we did have quite a lot of fans who really like Howman. We're like, oh, who is that actor? You know, who is he?
Well, I got to see, obviously I watched it, Make It Look Real at Adelaide, and then got to see, I was there, and I got to see With or Without You as well. So I had like this double whammy of Albert.
But I've seen a couple of his, because I watched quite a few of his other previous shows before we cast him. So I think he's an amazing talent and a great person. And just him and Sarah gave so much the role, because it was the documentary part, because they were both engaged as performers on Tightrope working with Kieran, and then also as participants on the documentary. So it was a big risk for them too, you know, that whole thing about we're all in this kind of big risk together, and we're all here to, because they were just uncertain, all these other documentary cameras around them, and you know, capturing their every thought throughout the process. So I think it was quite a unique experience for them, and they really went with it and let go a little bit, which I really appreciate. Yeah.
Well, talking with Albert, and he's, you know, how he will engage with stories going forward has changed. So that's really quite fascinating too.
Yeah. Yes. I read about that too. Yeah. His documentary part really, you know, opened up a lot.
It's good.
For him.
As a last question, talking about storytelling, and my focus is often on Australian storytellers. And so I'm curious for you what it means to be an Australian storyteller working today, telling Australian stories on screen.
Oh, that's a beautiful question. It means so much to me, and I feel very lucky, and I feel that, you know, an Australian story for me, what's always struck me about them is that, like one of my favorite films is Strictly Ballroom, which I watched, well, it was one of the first films I saw in the Demerick Street cinema. And what always strikes me about Australian films is there's this sort of huge empathy for, you know, these kind of, once again, kind of hidden figures, or people who are going to kind of come out of nowhere and do something really interesting, or be really bold or brave, or, you know, whether that's they're progressive in their viewpoint, and they're accepting, you know, like Muriel's Wedding, Priscilla, like all those 90s films, which I grew up with, which I still love. There's a real heartbeat in them, where it is about the people, and, you know, that sort of that diversity of voices and that equity and that sort of that Australian way, where we are really accepting and kind of welcoming of unusual characters who want to set out and do something. And, you know, the hero's journey, I've seen a lot through sort of Australian work, or like My Brilliant Career. I see Margaret Fink actually every sort of second day. She sort of shops where I shop, and I'm always like, I said to Bridget Eichen the other day, I'm like, oh, I want to just say hello to Margaret, you know. I had dinner with her on Saturday night. She's like, you should just go up to her. And you know, I loved My Brilliant Career, and I just find Australian filmmakers, we're a sort of smallish country, and we were always like pushing boundaries, you know, even in the 30s with isn't Madonna Sisters?
Yeah,
I can't remember, but you know, there were those sisters who were making films, like, and I just feel, it's like pushing boundaries, and that sort of like, there's a real spirit, a can-do kind of spirit as Australian filmmakers in our industry. And I really like to kind of be a part of that. And I think there's some people who are like even like I look at, you know, some filmmakers now, they're really punching above their weight, I guess. And that's what I think of when I think of Australian filmmakers.
Yes, definitely. I'm so excited to see where you go as a producer and, you know, what you do, because the stories that you've worked on are just like, we need it, right? And it's changing how we talk about stuff and how we talk about film.
Yeah.
And on a purely selfish level, that, I mean, that's what I love, because I love to be able to see Australian film change and shift and continue on as well. And it's through producers and storytellers like yourself. So thank you, Bethany. It means a lot.
Oh, it means a lot to me. I've really enjoyed this. I mean, it's rare that I get to share.
Thanks for listening to this chat with Bethany Bruce about her documentary Make It Look Real, which she's a producer of. It's now out on Netflix. For other interviews and reviews, visit thecurb.com.au. Please rate, review and share this interview with your film-loving friends. We hope they like it as much as you have. I'm Andrew F. Pierce, and I'll see you on the next one.